This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. How are you doing today?
All right, Dr. Hoffman, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And we're here to answer your questions, questions that you send to us via radio program at AOL.com. And we've got a new way to receive listener questions. Of course, you can call us during our live radio program from noon to 2 p.m. on Saturdays, where it's called Intelligent Medicine. And it's heard across the country on many stations, but you can also listen live via drhoffman.com. If you go to drhoffman.com, there's a little drop-down menu under Listen, and you can find a link where you can listen live on your mobile device, or you can listen via your computer. And you can now, so the new feature is that we have, if you notice, you go to drhoffman.com, do you notice this little black box or a little black line on the right? If you go to the homepage of drhoffman.com, and that is, what does that say if you go there, Lily?
It says, click here to send us a voicemail question.
Right. And we've been, people have been responding to that. They're just becoming aware of that option, and they've been recording questions. Hopefully questions of less than 20 minutes duration. Just, you know, make your question succinct, and we'll put that question on our live radio broadcast. Of course, you can always send questions to us the old-fashioned way. Radio program at AOL.com gets you questions. These are the questions that we answer on our weekly Q&A with Layla. Then, of course, you can also call us live on our radio program from noon to 2. Saturdays, Eastern Time, and the number is 888-302-3684, and we're happy to field your questions then, live on the radio. So now there's three ways to get questions to us, and there's another way to get questions to us, and that's to come see us directly at the Hoffman Center. You can make an appointment with me, and you'll get to see Layla as part of the deal, or if you want a more economical pathway to get nutritional advice, you can make an appointment with Layla at the Hoffman Center, and she'll guide you through your nutritional program. So let's start with questions. It's been a busy week in the wake of the election. I think a lot of people are still recovering. And so a lot of the health news has been eclipsed by some of the national news. There will be a lot.
We've got plenty of questions.
Yeah. Yes, we got plenty of questions, so let's tackle the questions.
All right. Eric writes, Eric sends us an email. He says, I have a sneaking suspicion that even natural sweeteners like stevia with no caloric content to speak of cause an insulin spike. Is there any evidence that non-caloric sweeteners cause an insulin spike?
Well, you actually,
I would say yes.
You've been all over that. I think you wrote you wrote several articles, or you did a podcast on that subject recently.
Yeah.
So talk to us about
way
that.
Way back in the day when sucralose came out and Splenda was a very big deal, you know, Dr. Atkins would tout it as a sweetener that you can take. But since then, it's been shown in the scientific literature that Splenda can indeed cause an insulin spike. Now, the other thing that we do know, the other artificial sweetener, NutraSweet, aspartame, the blue packet Equal, absolutely causes a spike in insulin. That's why many people, when they switch from, say, regular soda to a diet soda, it doesn't help their weight loss efforts. In fact, they can even plateau. If they're on a good weight loss, a low-carb weight loss diet, they completely plateau if they hang on to that diet soda or are using aspartame or NutraSweet in their morning coffee or tea. We don't have much evidence on stevia except anecdotally. And I think the biggest complaint that I hear from people is that, well, when I use stevia, I just want more, or I just have more craving for something sweet later in the day, or maybe I want a cookie if I'm putting stevia in my coffee or my tea or something like that. So my general recommendation is, if that's what's happening, then you should avoid it.
Indeed.
And so, indeed, it could cause an insulin spike.
Right. And there is,
some people,
you know, when you take in a sweet compound, you know, whether it's sugar or whether it's a sugar equivalent or whether it's a refined carbohydrate, there's several phases of response. You know, the first response is in your mouth, which delivers a signal immediately to your brain. Your brain lights up. And as a result of a sweet taste, whether it comes from an artificial sweetener or whether it comes from real sugar, there may be what's called a cerebral response. And the cerebral response works two ways. One, it reinforces your sugar craving, regardless of whether it's real sugar or not. So, you know, you may continue to have your sugar craving. And people who wean off of sugar and artificial sweeteners report ultimately a decreased desire for sugar. It tends to abate, you know, just like when you withdraw from drugs or tobacco or caffeine, anything that you crave, alcohol as well. So the other thing that may happen is that literally the brain may signal the pancreas, even before the food hits the digestive tract, gets into the stomach, to secrete insulin. So this may be a real thing, and it's a false signal because you obviously don't need insulin to digest a non-sugar compound. When you take sugar, and if you don't have insulin, say you're an insulin-dependent diabetic, your blood sugar will skyrocket because you don't have any insulin to take that sugar and lower it and push it into your cells to use as fuel. So there's a real possibility that stevia might cause this. And, you know, in the course of the other effects of some of these non-caloric sweeteners, they actually may alter the microbiome, according to new studies. They may change the composition of bacteria, thus having a metabolic effect, and that may be mediated through insulin as well. Now, we don't know if stevia does that. We know that NutraSweet does that. And what's the other one? Splenda.
Splenda. It's very interesting you bring up the microbiome because Eric also says, lately I've been taking a probiotic and I've noticed over the last 2 or 3 months that my sugar cravings have noticeably decreased. So that might be the mechanism of action, changing the microbiome, how it affects the brain, the gut-brain axis. And in addition, anybody with candida overgrowth, people will complain that my sugar cravings are crazy, but but the yeast overgrowth can cause craving and translate that craving to us. So we're actually craving sugar as a result of candida overgrowth. And taking a probiotic supplement can help crowd out the bad bacteria, possibly helping to reduce craving in that way. So that's interesting.
Indeed. So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, there's also this issue of candida hijacking the brain, in a sense, because from an evolutionary standpoint, the candida wants to live and perpetuate itself. And so there's new evidence that some of these microorganisms may take over their hosts in a way, commandeer the appetite of their hosts that the host preferentially takes in sugary foods or refined carbohydrates, which thus helps the population of yeast or harmful bacteria to thrive. So this is new think, but it really kind of gives credence to those people who say, when my candida is acting up, my sweet cravings are through the roof. And we tend to discount them saying, well, that's just your imagination, but maybe there really is something to it.
Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. So, Eric, you may be right.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. Thank you for your question.
Yep.
We've got an email from Tom, and Dr. Hoffman, Tom needs a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Tom says, I went to the doctor for some overactive bladder issues, and he put me on a medicine for a weak urine stream. This improved that. And, however, he did check. I don't have an enlarged prostate or anything like that. There was some red blood cells found in my urine. He was not concerned because my PSA is a 1. I don't have an enlarged prostate. And I'm otherwise healthy, so he advised me to come back in 3 months for another urine analysis. Is this the right course of action?
Okay. Well, you know, in medicine, we play the rule-out game. And in the case of urinary symptoms or blood in the urine, most doctors think, and you know, correctly so to some extent, that their main job is to make sure that nothing really life-threatening or dangerous is happening to you. So, in the case of blood in the urine, they'll do thorough testing. They may check the kidneys to see if there's a stone in the kidneys, or worse yet, if there's a cancer in the kidneys. They'll check the urine to see if there's an ongoing infection which may cause blood to be present in the urine. They may literally go up into the bladder and use the cystoscope to visualize the bladder wall to see if there's inflammation or to see if there's tumor, just to make sure that nothing's going on there. And then once you've ruled out this, that, and the other, all manner of harmful conditions, they say, okay, yeah, you have a little blood in your urine, or it's actually, you can't see it because it's what's called microscopic hematuria, which is pretty common. And they will call it benign hematuria, which means, it's a little abnormal, but this doesn't portend any, you know, underlying serious condition. Now, you know, from a holistic standpoint, you know, clearly the presence of blood in the urine may indicate that something's not right. And we may want to go further with maybe checking to see whether there's a food intolerance that's causing inflammation, something along those lines, where we can, you know, combat the inflammation, maybe use anti-inflammatory nutrients or something along those lines to assuage that problem. So what are some of the things you'd recommend to someone who has urinary frequency? This is called OAB, overactive bladder, right?
Right.
You know, which, by the way, it's just like ED. It has an acronym. We've actually assigned it. It's such a common problem that we've given it a name. Usually things get names when they invent drugs. You know, ED became a phenomenon when we had Viagra, and OAB has become a phenomenon because we have a whole raft of medications. You see them advertised on TV a lot, which help people, you know, get through ball games and plays and, you know, without running the bathroom all the time, long car rides and so on. So, OAB, however, does respond to sometimes to dietary measures. So what are some of those that you might recommend?
Well, food allergens are a common culprit. So removing, you know, the elimination of any foods that you may be allergic to, sensitive to, have any kind of idiosyncratic reaction to. Caffeine is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Getting rid of the morning cup of coffee or tea or that afternoon cup of coffee or something. People find that they get relief when they don't take stimulants like caffeine. Other things to get rid of would be any pro-inflammatory foods, sugars, refined carbohydrates, pro-inflammatory vegetable oils, sugar substitutes, as we just talked about a little earlier. These can be problematic because they can stimulate the bladder.
MSG,
as well.
Do you think might be among those?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
MSG causes a whole host of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's a topic for a separate podcast altogether, but MSG is problematic for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A whole lot of GI issues, bladder issues, neurological, but bladder certainly.
Chemicalized food, you know, perhaps.
Yeah, chemicalized food. Chocolate may be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, folks. Sorry, chocolate lovers.
Well, you have to, I mean, it's not a strict prohibition for everybody who has OAB, but it's worth it to do a trial of elimination of some of the potential precipitants to see if you can not depend on these medications, because unfortunately these medications have side effects. They target the bladder, but they have what are called off-target effects. They can give you dry mouth. They can make you feel tired or mentally dull. And there's actually, these are often what are called cholinergic medications. And cholinergic medications in the elderly are sometimes responsible for worsening dementia. So, you know, in the very population, certainly it's mostly older people who are suffering from OAB, we're giving them powerful medications to slow their urinary stream, but it may have a cognitive effect on them. So that would be a rationale for trying a more natural approach to this.
Right. Yeah. Okay, Tom, thank you very much for your email.
Yep.
Best of health to you. All right, we've got an email from Gary. Gary is an RN who works in a hospital, and he's refused the flu shot for the last 3 years and has to wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Gary has two autoimmune conditions controlled naturally. Gary's worried about, if he takes the flu shot, worried about Guillain-Barré syndrome, even with the preservative-free vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And Gary's asking if he's at risk for Guillain-Barré syndrome with the autoimmune condition.
What Guillain-Barré syndrome is there's actually it was actually something that occurred with one of the vaccines that was developed. I think it was back in during the Ford administration. So way back when, you know, I guess that was in the 80s, where people, you know, this is one of the reasons why they create a lot of distrust about vaccines, is they drummed up a lot of concern about the swine flu, which was this new deadly flu that was going to descend on America, and everybody had to get this new swine flu vaccine. And it did cause a certain, you know, while this is a rare side effect, it did cause a measurable number of cases of Guillain-Barré. Now, Guillain-Barré is a devastating neurological syndrome that causes paralysis and weakness. And clearly related to the flu vaccine. Now, we don't see that much in the way of Guillain-Barré syndrome with the current flu vaccine. But with an ongoing autoimmune condition, there are causes for concern. You know, the vaccine authorities might minimize these concerns. But when vaccines are made, number one, just by virtue of their the fragment of the virus that they contain, they stimulate the immune system. They're designed to cause an immune response, because if they don't cause an immune response, your immune system won't learn to fight off whatever pathogen they're trying to vaccinate you against. But also, every vaccine contains what are called adjuvants, which amp up your immune response, which is good because some people don't have a very good immune response. They need to have their immune response to the vaccine amped up to make the vaccine effective. But also, it can cause a generalized activation of your immune system. So rather than the likelihood of Guillain-Barré, which is kind of a long shot, the underlying immune autoimmune condition might be activated, such as MS or such as rheumatoid arthritis. One of those conditions, right. So at least this is a theoretical concern. And I think it's warranted for I forget the name of the questioner, for him to
Gary
mm-hmm. to be concerned. On the other hand, conventional medicine doesn't recognize this, and he's not likely to get a vaccine exemption on account of this. I mean, certainly we understand why hospitals want hospital personnel to be vaccinated, because the flu, while, you know, it's going to cause misery for the normal person, somebody in a hospital, an elderly or debilitated person, sick person, might have a very, very serious consequence of having the flu. So we get the rationale for this. The problem is that individual freedom of choice gets subordinated to the need for protective measures in a hospital. This is one of the dilemmas that face health professionals. Many of them don't want to get the flu vaccine, but that's kind of the condition of work. But they're offering him the option of wearing a mask.
Yeah, I think those who refuse the flu shot have to wear a mask.
Right.
I believe if you're working in a hospital,
This poses another dilemma, because you can imagine the strange impression this might give to patients, you know, saying, gee, everybody comes into my room, all these doctors and nurses come to this room, but there's this one guy who comes in wearing a mask all the time. He must really be sick.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay away from this guy. Or maybe he's like, you know, sick in the head. Maybe he's a germphobe or something. Why is that guy who comes to my room, you know, all the time to take my temperature wearing a mask? Is he afraid of me?
Right.
or should I be afraid of him?
Yeah. Yeah. And in listening to at a conference recently, a Dr. Susan Blum, who was talking specifically about autoimmune conditions and leaky gut, that anybody who's getting a flu shot or any other type of vaccination should not have their ANA checked for 2 to 3 months afterwards because it might reveal a false positive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which really attests to the potency of these vaccines in terms of activating latent autoimmune tendencies. You know, this suggests that these people have maybe a tendency towards autoimmunity. And, you know, so maybe, maybe there really is something to it.
Mm-hmm. Best of luck to you, Gary. All right.
Yeah. And next time I'm in the hospital, I'll look for you. I'll recognize you because you'll be the guy with wearing the mask.
We have an email from Marie. Dear Dr. Hoffman, my brother finished a round of chemo and radiation for mouth cancer, and he's very frustrated because the burnt areas in his throat are not healing fast enough. He's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
He's rinsing his mouth with Diflucan several times daily. He's also having to get up several times a night to use biotin for his dry mouth.
It's a moisturizer.
Is there anything he can apply?
It's a mouth moisturizer.
Topically?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the medication that he's using, he's using Nizoral?
Yeah, Diflucan.
Oh, Diflucan, I'm sorry. Yeah, these are both antifungals.
And biotin for
right.
the dry mouth.
So Diflucan is a powerful antifungal, and very commonly people with mouth issues, radiation, some form of immunosuppression get yeast, and the yeast is, any woman who has had a yeast infection will tell you that it just burns, it's uncomfortable and red. And so the thought is that at least some of his burning might be due to a yeast infection, so-called oral thrush. But that does not do anything for the inflammation that the radiation might have caused. It's just make sure that there's no yeast overgrowth. And so what are some of the things that will help heal the mouth? Well, we really like glutamine.
We like L-glutamine.
Yeah.
L-glutamine, you could do a swish and swallow using L-glutamine powder and some water.
Right.
Several times a day.
Like about a half teaspoon in water.
A half teaspoon.
Maybe four times daily. The other thing that is helpful is DGL lozenges. And there's no limit to how many of those. You can suck on those all day long. You can have two dozen of those a day. And DGL is very anti-inflammatory and soothing. So try that. And the other thing would be aloe vera gel. And our favorite brand is Lily of the Desert. You can buy it in bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can get a so-called ice plant. A lot of people keep an ice plant in their kitchen in case of burns. It's really soothing to apply that to the skin. And you can just take some aloe gel. In this case, swish in the mouth, but also swallow it because the problem's in the throat. And it might be soothing for that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. All right, Marie.
Yeah.
Best of luck to your brother.
Yeah, it's a serious issue. And, you know, make sure that the nutritional status is good because that'll help with the healing. And sometimes if you have mouth problems and you have burning, it's hard to eat the right food. So make sure you take, a good multi to fill in the nutritional gaps, right?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. Or even, you know, people who really have problems eating and swallowing, we might give them some intravenous vitamins. And, you know, that's
true.
That's a workaround for people who have trouble assimilating their nutrients.
Right.
Okay. Well, as you listeners know, we divide these podcasts into two parts. So it's time to flip the LP over to side two, or in modern parlance. Go to part two of our podcast. And give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about in part two.
Okay. Do you have any tips for the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia?
Okay, that's a challenging condition. We'll talk about that in part two. This is our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.